All right, I'd like to share with you this morning from the book of Genesis again. And I spoke on this a while ago, maybe 2 months ago, something like that. So I'm going to start today with a little review about what we talked about last time, then I'll continue on. Last time we only got through the first four chapters of the book of Genesis, so I'm going to have to go a lot more quickly this time in order to get through the rest of it. I'm not ready to go through the entire book of Genesis, but we'll go through the next couple of chapters. We learned in the first chapter of Genesis about this character, God. He's introduced to us for the first time, and we learn a couple of different things about God just from the very first chapter, the creation story. We learn that he is a God who shines light out of the darkness. And this is picked up by later biblical writers, and they understand it's not just about God being a God who can snap his fingers and create light and electromagnetism and all the complex science that goes behind that, but we also understand from this that just like God created physical light, he's a God who shines in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's 2 Corinthians 4:6. So God is a God who gives us knowledge. He reveals things for the way that they truly are, just like light. He's a God who sees darkness and says, "Let there be light." He's also a God who takes the deep, these overwhelming waters, and he relegates them to their place. So we read, for example, in the book of Job. Job talks about this, and he says, God is the one who set the boundaries for the seas, and he said, "This far you may come, and no further. And here must your proud waves stop." So God is a God who is able to take this deep waters, overwhelming everything, so much more power than any thing that we could comprehend as humans. And he is able to take all of that and put it into its place. It's nothing compared to the power of God. Nothing that we can face in our lives is anything compared to the power of God. And then we learned about how God is a God who takes this world that is formless and empty, and he gives it an order. He gives names to things. He divides them into their proper places, everything in its proper place with its proper name, and he fills the emptiness with living creatures in the sky and the sea and on the land, and filling the sky with light. So God is a God who takes our empty lives as well, and he fills them up. He's a God who takes our lives that have no purpose or meaning, and he gives them a purpose and a meaning. He gives us names. He guides us and orders our lives. So all these things that we see God doing in the physical creation, he also does with us spiritually. And there's so many more things we could list here. But then we find out that God creates the first man and the first woman, and he puts them in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. He provides them with abundant waters. You know, water is a big theme in the book of Genesis. We often see God providing later for the patriarchs. He provides them water from wells. And we know way later on in the book of John, Jesus picks up this theme and he says, "Well, I can give you water so that you'll never thirst." But we see here God providing physical water. And this is, again, a kind of a sign that God can also provide spiritual water to satisfy our spiritual thirst. So he provides for Adam, all of Adam and Eve's physical needs. But then there's this tree in the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God warns the first man and the first woman, "Don't eat from this tree." But the serpent tempts Eve. He tells her, "God is trying to keep something good from you." Eve does not trust God, and she decides to trust the serpent instead. Adam and Eve take the fruit from this tree, and their eyes are opened, and they are exposed. And the serpent, just like the Satan in the rest of the Bible, is always trying to take God's people and say, "These people, look at these people. I'm going to expose them for who they really are. They're really not that great." He takes Job, and he says, this guy Job, he's just being good because you're giving him all these blessings. If you took that away, then his selfishness would be made manifest. Or we see him later on accusing a high priest and saying this guy isn't worthy of being a priest to God. But God, in all of these situations, God is the adversary of the serpent. And even as the serpent is trying to take God's people and expose them as sinful, God is the one who is always somehow providing some kind of a solution. He gives the high priest new garments. He gives Adam and Eve new clothes as well. They try to cover up their own shame, their own guilt, but they can't do it themselves. They just have leaves to try to cover themselves. God apparently kills the first animal and gives them clothing from the animal's skin. And there's a curse that comes as a result of this sin. There's three curses that mirror the three blessings that we read in the creation story. But in the middle of all the cursing, there's a promise that through the, just like sin, a temptation, kind of came through Eve, and she was the instrument by which her husband was tempted. God also promises that through Eve is going to come, through her descendants, through her seed, is going to eventually come someone who will be able to crush the serpent's head, even though the serpent crushes this descendant's heel. And Adam recognizes this, so he gives Eve a name to reflect her role as the mother of all living. And then we read about Adam and Eve's children. And we might hope that these will be the promised children who will finally overcome the serpent and usher in some kind of a new age. But unfortunately, we find that Adam and Eve's children repeat the same mistakes that Adam and Eve made. And God warns Cain not to be angry, and that he will be accepted if he does what is good. And he warns Cain in chapter 4 in verse 7 that sin lies at the door and its desire is for you, but you need to rule over it. But Cain does not rule over the sin. Sin instead rules over him, and he kills his brother out of jealousy, and is punished, and God again curses the ground. He says that Cain is going to be banished from his home, and he's not going to he's not going to be able to the ground will no longer produce food for him. This is very similar to the curse that Adam got, where the ground was not going to produce food without a lot of toil and sweat. So, but God also shows mercy to Cain. He shows restraints, that instead of punishing Cain the way that he deserved for killing his brother, instead of killing him, God says, I'm just going to banish you. And in fact, God even puts a mark on Cain to protect him from some other members of his family trying to take vengeance on him and kill him. And God promises, I'm going to actually protect you. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And then we kind of see what happens as a result of this, of God showing mercy to Cain. And we read about Cain's descendants, and we read that they're very intelligent. They invent musical instruments, they invent metallurgy and keeping livestock, all of these very extremely complicated things. Being able to make bronze and iron is an extremely complex process, but Cain's descendants were able to perfect it within a few generations. Clearly, the problem with humanity is not that they're dumb. The problem is not that they're united. It's all one family, right? This is in many ways what the world kind of views as a utopia situation, where everyone is together. There's no more divisions between different nations. If we could only be educated and smart, then everything would be great. And so we see God allowing humanity to sort of have it all, without restraint. God even is showing a lot of mercy and letting them decide how they want to behave. And we see exactly what humanity does with all this freedom. We read about the life of Lamech, he decides to, instead of going with the way God ordained marriage to be between a man and a woman, Lamech decides to take two wives. And then, even more than that, Lamech decides to act in the role of God. And we see the end of chapter 4, Lamech brags to his wives about how some young man had injured him in some way, and that to get revenge on this young man, he killed him. And he said, if Cain's going to be avenged 7 times, then I'm going to be avenged 77 times, 77-fold. So Lamech looked at the example of God showing mercy to Cain, where God promised that he would protect Cain and take vengeance if anything happened to Cain. Lamech says, well, now I'm going to act in the role of God, but I'm going to do it even better. If anyone so much as injures me, I'm going to take vengeance 77-fold. And so we see early humanity is doing what we have always done, trying to act in the role of God and insert our own morality in the place of God's morality, and with disastrous results. But in the middle of all this, there is some hope. We find out that Adam and Eve had another son, and they named him Set, because he was set by God instead of Abel. And then we read that men began to call on the name of the Lord, which is a little bit of a theme that gets repeated throughout the rest of Genesis, people calling on the name of the Lord, and God sometimes answering people, and sometimes people not calling on the name of the Lord, but instead looking to themselves. So we have this story so far is the story of the first creation and its corruption. So and the end of chapter 4 closes out this first section in the book of Genesis that's labeled the proceedings of the heavens and the earth, and we get to chapter 5. We'll read about the proceedings of Adam. So in chapter 5 and verse 1, we read, this is the book of the genealogy, or this is what came out from Adam. In the day that the Lord God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. And he created them male and female and blessed them and called them mankind in the day that they were created. And then we read this genealogy. I'm not going to read through all this in case you were worried about that. I'll just tell you the gist of this whole genealogy. Everybody dies. That's the story of Adam. That's the legacy of Adam. The legacy of Adam is death. So-and-so lived so many years, and he died. Except for one person. And there's one person in this genealogy who does not follow in the legacy of Adam, and he is not recorded to have died. So that's a big thing, you know, in a genealogy, when you come across someone and it's recording everyone else's deaths, but it doesn't record this one person's death. Clearly, there's something very special about this. So let's read that part of the genealogy. Yes, this is Enoch. He was the seventh from Adam. We read in chapter 5 and verse 24 that Enoch walked with God, and he was not, because God took him. And that's all we read about Enoch. There's no mention of his death. It just says that he was not, God took him. And it says that he walked with God. In Hebrew, the word walked isn't just like he, you know, went on a stroll with God, but it's a reflexive form of the verb. It's like something he did habitually. It's he walked together with God, and what it means is he oriented his life around God. He lived in a way that he was following God. So unlike Lamech, who we read about in earlier, who made himself his own God, Enoch aligns himself with God. And as a result of that, he escapes the legacy of death that came from Adam. And so this begs the question, what does it look like exactly to walk with God? What does it mean to walk with God? And that's something that's explored throughout the rest of the book of Genesis, and we start to see more and more of these characters come along, and we find out what it means to walk with God. And we first read about Noah, And then we read about Abraham, and that's where we really get all of the juicy details about what a life that is oriented around God looks like. And so this concept is very important moving forward. But right now it's being introduced to us to kind of suck us into the narrative, make us want to find out what happens next. What does this mean? And how is Enoch able to escape this legacy of death that came from Adam? And as we get towards the end of this genealogy, I'm going to read a couple more verses. In verse 28, we read about another Lamech. This is a different Lamech. In verse 28 of chapter 5, Lamech lived 182 years and had a son. And he called his son's name Noah, which means comfort, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." And so we find out something about Lamech and what his concerns are. He is very concerned about all of this labor and this work that they have to do and how hard it is to make food come up from the ground. And he hopes that Noah will be the instrument through which this curse is alleviated. And this curse, of course, is tied up. This is because God cursed the ground because of sin. So Lamech hopes that Noah will be somehow an instrument of alleviation. And so we see that the promise that God made all the way back to Adam and Eve, that through Eve's descendants there would be some kind of person who could crush the serpent's head, it seems that that has filtered through all the generations, and now Lamech and everyone else is still expecting eventually one of their descendants is going to be able to finally break this curse. But Lamech is all concerned about physical things, and that's the things that he talks about when he names Noah. But we'll see that God has some different plans for Noah. So we can move on now to chapter 6. And in chapter 6, we're going to read about the state of early humanity. Chapter 6 and verse 1, we read, "It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, 'My spirit will not always strive with man forever. He is indeed flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. And there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And so he said, 'I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beasts, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them.' But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." So there's a lot going on in this, at the beginning of this chapter. But there's a few sort of big picture things to take away. One is that early humanity was strong. There wasn't any issues of them not being capable. They were capable of doing whatever they set their minds to. That's what God says later on in the Tower of Babel. There was not an issue of incompetence here. These early people were mighty men, men of renown. They were sort of the pinnacle of human achievement. But what we see is that God has given them a lot of free rein. Now we see God saying, "I'm going to start clamping down on all this freedom." Because what humanity did with all of the freedom that they had is they went and they filled the earth with violence. And so now God says, "All right, there's going to be this 120 years." And we see later on in the book of Genesis, after the flood especially, God starts shortening lifespan. He divides languages at the Tower of Babel, and he puts all these measures in place to sort of block humanity from being able to achieve all that they would be able to achieve without any restrictions. So this is kind of like way back at the Garden of Eden when God said, I'm not going to let Adam and go and eat from the tree of life and live forever. There needs to be some restriction on this. But someone could easily say, well, God, you know, you're putting all these restrictions on humanity. If you just let them have more freedom, then everything would be great and we would finally achieve world peace. But what we read in the book of Genesis is the claim that God did allow all this freedom, and what humanity did with that freedom, with God's mercy that he showed to Cain, with the long lifespans that he gave them, with their being united, they took that and they used all that freedom to fill the earth with violence. And we read about what God is concerned about, and he says that every thought is only, all the time, evil. It's a very, very strong language in verse 5 that God uses to describe the intents of mankind. And it says that God was sorry that he had made man on the earth and that he was grieved in his heart. And the wording of this passage, it's not so clear in English, but in Hebrew, the wording of this is the same as Lamech's statement earlier, where he was hoping that Noah would comfort them concerning their work and the toil of their hands. Lamech was all concerned about the physical world. God is concerned about the spiritual side of things. And it says that he was sorry and he was grieved, using very similar language. And so we see a contrast between what humanity is concerned about and what God is concerned about. And God says that he will undo creation, essentially. He's going to destroy all these things that he made. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so in the middle of this curse that's about to come, there is mercy. And we see by this point, from the stories that we've read before, that God is a God of mercy. He's a God of justice. But in all of the instances where he's judged previously, there's been mercy, and this case is no different. So we read now in verse 9, this next section of the book of Genesis, about the proceedings of Noah. What came from Noah? What was the legacy of Noah? In chapter 6, verse 9 says, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. So just like Enoch, Noah aligned himself with God. And we'll get more details about what that means in the life of Noah. So we read in verse 10, Noah had three sons. He had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. It's very similar to the way the world is today, except now there's more of a restraint on it because humanity isn't as doesn't have as much freedom. God, the Bible says that God is restraining the evil of mankind on earth. But still, we see early humanity, modern humanity, it's all the same thing. Our hearts are evil, and the earth is corrupt and filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and indeed it was corrupt. In verse 12, all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah in verse 13, the end of all flesh has come before me, because the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So God says that mankind is destroying the earth, and so I'm going to destroy mankind together with the earth. And he says to Noah, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and out with pitch. And we don't know exactly what gopher wood is. It sounds kind of similar to the English word cover. It's maybe not completely clear, but gopher and cover, it's kind of similar, right? And it also sounds very similar to the English word, or to the Hebrew word for pitch, which is used here, which just is like cover. It's a covering. And so maybe this was, there's speculation, this was some kind of tree with that had sap that you could get pitch from. But anyway, clearly there's attention being drawn in this verse to that word, that idea of covering. Because he says, get this gopher wood, cover it with a covering. And this kind of harkens back to in the story of Adam and Eve, where God provided a covering for Adam and Eve. It's a different Hebrew word used in that passage. But it's the same concept. God says, make yourself a covering, and it'll protect you from this coming judgment. And he gives Noah instructions about how to make the ark. Everything is given in a lot of detail. He says that he's bringing flood waters in verse 17 on the earth. So in the creation story, God, a big part of that is God putting the waters into their place. Now it's saying that God is going to bring the deep back on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, in which is the breath of life. But in verse 18, God says, I will establish my covenant with you. You shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. So God, for the first time, brings up this concept of a covenant, an agreement that he is going to make with Noah. And he tells Noah to gather food and animals in order to preserve their life. He gives all of these very detailed instructions, and at the very end, in verse 22, we read, thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. That's a repeated statement. Noah did it according to everything that God commanded him, he did it. So this statement is very important. God speaks, and Noah does just as God said. This is just like the physical world responded to God. When God spoke, the physical world responded and did exactly what God told it to do. And in the same way, when God speaks, Noah does exactly what God tells him to do. And so we're going to see God's creative work here, except instead of in the physical world, in the life of Noah, as Noah does what God commands him to do. Through Noah, God is going to establish some new things, a new covenant. So God tells Noah in chapter 7, verse 1, come into the ark, you and all your household. I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. And he tells him to take all these animals into the ark. And we read again in verse 5, Noah did according to all that the Lord God commanded him. So we're seeing here something about what it means to walk with God. It means obedience. And Noah was a man who obeyed what God told him to do. And he was 600 years old in verse 6 of chapter 7 when the flood waters were on the earth. And Noah, with his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. And all these animals went in with him, and the waters of the flood were on the earth. And in verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, in the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and all of the windows of heaven were opened. So the deep makes its appearance again, and it again covers the earth. And in verse 18, the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. And in verse 21, all flesh died that moved on the earth. In verse 23, so God destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground. Both man and cattle, creeping thing and birds of the air, they were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him on the ark remained alive. So this is the third time God has cursed the ground, or destroyed the ground for the sake of humanity. But we read in chapter 8, in verse 1, that God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. And then Noah sends out this raven and this dove, and eventually they are able to come out of the ark. And the Lord speaks to Noah in verse 15 Lord spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your son and your son's wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh." And in verse 18, Noah went out with and his sons and his wife and his son's wives with him. There's all these things that Noah had are listed again and again. God preserved everything that Noah had and all of his family. And they all come out of the ark. And Noah built, in verse 20 of chapter 8, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal, every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. This is verse 21. Then the Lord said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done." So we see here that Noah fulfilled the prophecy that came with his name. Lamech was hoping that Noah would be an instrument of alleviation from God's cursing of the ground. And here we see that God does say, "I will never again curse the ground for the sake of mankind." And so this is a very hopeful time. In the next chapter, we read about how God established his covenant with Noah and his descendants, and he gave them the rainbow as a sign of this covenant, this agreement, never again to destroy the earth with a flood. But God also does some other things here. He establishes in verse 6 of chapter 9, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed." So no longer is there going to be the same leniency that God showed with Cain. Now there is going to be some stricter restrictions on humanity. But God establishes his covenants with Noah. He gives him the sign. So Noah and his children go out from the ark, and everything seems great. It seems almost like this Noah could be the promised descendants of the woman who would finally crush the head of the serpent. Nothing bad has been mentioned about Noah so far. It says he was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. He walked with God. So we might start to think maybe this Noah is finally going to be able to not be like Adam, but to be better than Adam. But we read in verse 20 that of chapter 9, Genesis 9:20, Noah began to be a farmer. And in Hebrew, what this says is Noah was a man of earth, just like Adam was a man of the earth. He was a man of the Adamah. And so that just sounds a little foreboding. It says he planted a vineyard. And he, in verse 21, he drank wine from the vineyard and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. So this is just like the story of Adam. Noah was a man of the earth, and his nakedness was uncovered. He was exposed. And there's this whole thing with his children. Some of them make fun of him, exploit his weakness, and some of them don't. And so we see that this family that we might have hoped would finally be the ones who would usher in a new age of peace and obedience to God are deeply flawed. And there Noah is exposed, and the behavior of his children is exposed. And we see that, unfortunately, this is not going to be something that's very different from what's come before. And so we're still waiting for the promised person who will finally come, this child of promise who will come and finally crush the serpent's head. And that's what we wait for as humanity is dispersed and God sends everyone to all across the globe at the Tower of Babel. And he picks out one person from all of those people who are going around. He picks out Abraham. And through the life of Abraham, we start to see more details about what a life of obedience, or equivalently, what a life of faith looks like. Because faith and obedience are really almost two sides of the same coin. If you have faith in God, if you trust him, then you will obey him. And if you don't obey God, it means you don't trust him. So they're very related concepts. Adam and Eve did not have faith in God. They believed the serpent. Noah had faith in God, but he was a flawed person. And Abraham had faith in God, but we see through Abraham's life the details and the complexity of this journey. There were times when Noah didn't trust God. There were times when he did trust God. And his faith has ups and downs, but ultimately he learns to trust God, and God makes a covenant with Abraham that through his descendants, all the world would be blessed. And so we could see this hope for the future. This promised child is still promised. It's still coming, even though this process to get there is very long and painful. We see this hope for the future established in the book of Genesis. So I'm going to close in prayer now. Lord, I thank you for your word and for all of the beauty that is in your word, and all of the things about your character and your love for us. I thank you that we, even though we are all deeply flawed, we are very much following in the legacy of our ancestor Adam, that you have washed us clean in the blood of your son. And I thank you that we all who have faith in you can trust that you will protect us and guide us. And finally, I thank you that your son was the promised descendant of the woman who crushed the serpent's head. And I thank you that we can all benefit and rejoice in his victory today. I thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.